Welcome back, Hack Dissection, here for another episode. A little bit later, I'm back from Vegas. Hair is still a little bit different. I got my Vegas hair going, and we're rocking the Red Team Village DEF CON 33 shirt. So this is what we gave to our volunteers that helped us out, and just trying to represent a little bit. But for this episode, we have somebody that I've been wanting to get on since the beginning here, somebody that I've worked with for probably 4 years now. Mm-hmm. And just an area that's like really complementary to the areas that I work in over at Maltec. So I have Brandon Finton, president of Orion Secure, formerly Cyber Defense Institute. So Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the change here. So it's Orion Secure now. It was Cyber Defense Institute.
Yep.
And can you just walk us through like that little bit of change and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, so 2009, you know, 16 years ago, actually here in September, started as Cyber Defense Institute, did a lot of certification training, whether it be on the IT or security side. We also did a lot of the in-house cybersecurity training and just a little bit of professional services. But over the years, especially with, you know, computer-based learning, you know, the big players like KnowBe4 and that sort of thing, security training has really kind of limited to, like I said, computer-based training. And now we focus almost exclusively on professional services.
Got it. So back in 2009, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the regulations and things were very different than today. So some of that certification stuff, is it still relevant as much or has it really changed over time?
When we're looking at the certification stuff, a lot of the kind of stuff that we did was, you know, like your CISSPs, your CSM, you know, whether it be, you know, ISC squared or ISACA. Also did some of the network training. So, you know, like you can get your CCNA, your Cisco Certified Network Associate. I think a lot of those certifications are still very relevant in the IT space. I mean, CISSP is still that gold standard. You know,
sure.
You got to have that 5 years of experience to get it. You got to know someone who has it to get it. And that's kind of still the, you know, if you really want to be in the field. Doing any kind of like consulting, that kind of thing. I know that when we work with like state auditors and stuff like that, they expect at least that
somebody on the team or somebody that they're working with has that certification in place.
Yep.
So you worked, at Cyber Defense, you were helping other organizations get folks certified in those regards. And then things kind of evolved, right? Because now you're more in the service-based realm of things,
yep.
Right? So tell us a little bit more about that. Like what are the things that you're helping businesses with?
Yeah. So with that professional services focus, it's still very much working directly with clients. Kind of think that most everything kind of surrounds our virtual CISO programming. So that's a lot of, you know, companies outsourcing us to kind of create and manage their cybersecurity programs. And then all of the kind of facets that go around that cybersecurity program, whether it be, you know, policy development and management, risk assessments. If you're in a highly regulated environment, then we can help you with compliance. We can do that training through, you know, online training platforms, penetration testing, vulnerability management, incident response, you know, training or, you know, planning,
mm-hmm.
Disaster recovery planning, that sort of thing. So kind of that full gamut of we'll come into a smaller company and look, we're going to put together your program and manage it for you.
See, I think that's what's really going to be interesting to talk a little bit more about is because as I've talked to small business owners, their main focus has been their business area, right? It's not cybersecurity. It's, you know, if they work in health services, healthcare services, like their focus is that, and they're not thinking about cybersecurity stuff or if they're, you know, in construction or whatever. But to me, like having somebody like you out there to assist and make them understand at least the essentials of what they should be looking at or taking into consideration is super valuable because it allows them to offload that work and offload that responsibility, or at least like have somebody that is knowledgeable about it to assist them. Yep. So they can focus on the things that are basically core to them staying in business. Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those a little bit. So a couple of things that come to mind that every organization should have,
yep.
Whether you're, you know, just starting out, if you're growing, whatever, you need to be doing something related to cybersecurity. So what would that entail? Information security policies, right?
Yep.
So can we, let's talk about those just a little bit.
Yeah. So written information security policy is one of kind of the acronyms that, you know, we love in IT and especially love in IT security. So your WISP, in that case, we kind of put together what I call the guardrails in terms of what your cybersecurity program is going to look like, both from the employee side. So that's like your acceptable use policy saying, you know, how are you going to use our IT systems responsibly, and into the technical kind of side of things. You know, how are we going to, you know, set up and manage our backups? How are we going to control access controls? Now, these are written. This is not, you know, when a lot of people get into IT and IT security and stuff like that, everyone's thinking, oh, we're going to put in firewalls, we're going to put in EDR, MDR, or, you know, we're going to put it on all this kind of stuff. Well, you kind of need to start with that policy to kind of set the guardrails for kind of what we're going to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that essentially the policy is going to be their source of truth. So if they're deciding to build out what their information security, the whole policy or the whole like program within their organization, starting with that is going to be essential to have something to refer back to. So if somebody says, hey, I have an employee that's starting, how are we supposed to onboard them with equipment? Are they bringing in their own equipment? Like all of those questions, you have some place to refer back to. And that also gives you what, like a source of truth for auditors, for insurance, those types of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we get down to that employee side, some companies will say, oh no, we're really small. We kind of have that family kind of dynamic to, you know, the way we work and that sort of thing. However, if you don't set those expectations and you don't put them in writing, you can never hold someone accountable for doing something stupid or egregious or that sort of thing. And you know, I'm not an attorney, but on the employment side, you know, if you're firing someone for that, how can you say that they knew?
Sure.
So that's where we put those kind of policies in place. Same thing on the technical side. We say, all right, this is how, you know, how we're going to do this. On the regulatory side, everything you can think of on the regulatory side, whether it be the New York Shield Law, which applies to every single business that has data on New York residents. There's California, they got CCPA, if you've got California data. We keep going on. Get into healthcare, you got HIPAA. Get into credit cards, you've got PCI. You know, the list just goes on and on and on. And the first thing of every single one of those regulations is a written information security policy. And so the other question is, if you're trying to get like a cyber liability policy, they give you a questionnaire. Some of them are, you know, 10 questions. Some of them are 10 pages. They always ask the same thing. Do you have a policy?
Sure. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that you have to have all those things in place from the get-go. It's just a matter of, we're going to define what this is, and then we're going to work after that to start implementing these and to make sure that we're abiding by what we've written down and saying that that's what we're doing, right? So if it says, hey, we're going to have multi-factor, we may not have it yet, but we're going to implement it, and that's going to be the plan. Like, that's how we're going to proceed. Or yep, if somebody asks us, you know, what are we supposed to do? It just gives you, I guess, some sort of evidence, right? Or some sort of just tangible proof of, hey, we're not completely negligent here. We're trying to do something. We're defining what it is, and then we're working to implement that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could take a small business and it, you know, their information security policy may be only just a couple pages. It doesn't have to be horribly long to cover a lot of the things. I mean, when you start getting into the more regulated fields, obviously, they're going to say specific things that you have to have covered in your policy, so it gets a little bit longer. But kind of to piggyback off like your MFA thing where you're saying where we're going to do it, the worst thing you can possibly do, and I will say this 10 times in this podcast if I need to, there's only one thing worse than not having a policy, and that's having a policy you don't follow.
Mm.
So if you say you're going to do something and you don't do it, you have admitted that you knew you were supposed to do it.
Mm, interesting.
That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have language in there to say MFA. Maybe what we say is, we're going to implement MFA by this date, or, you know, we should have it done. We can play around with those shoulds and musts to mm-hmm. some extent, but, you know, we still want to have that policy to cover those kinds of things. MFA is definitely one of those things that we want to have in there, but we also don't want to the one that seems to always get people in trouble is they say everything will be encrypted at the whole disk level.
Yep.
And then you find out, you're like, well, how are you going to run BitLocker on your, you know, virtual machine? Or, you know, how are you going to run BitLocker on your, you know, whole disk encryption on your hypervisor after it's already been set up?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So now we got to put in the policy. Okay. Starting this date going forward, a new equipment will have that. So it's just kind of that kind of tweaking.
So that's a situation where if a business is already established and they're looking to now take advantage or start implementing cybersecurity things, policies, procedures, that sort of stuff. It's not like a showstopper if they don't, if they haven't like defined all these things from the start. Like you can kind of amend it to where they're at now and then moving forward, working towards improving that.
Yeah, absolutely. Any of these kind of documentation kind of things that we get into within cybersecurity, the, you know, we call it the governance risk compliance, the GRC part of it, they're all living documents. Your information security policy, including like your incident response policy, your incident response plan, business continuity or disaster recovery plans, they're all living documents. Risk assessments, all living documents. You should be looking at them at least annually or after what we call major changes. You know, there's a lot of companies now that are moving from the traditional, you know, server room in the, you know, the closet up to, you know, like an Azure or AWS kind of hosting. That's a major change. Let's, you know, look at our policies. Let's look at our risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not documents that you really want to create once and then just say, yeah, we're done.
Right.
It really should be kind of working with the business, massaging, you know, what you're doing, kind of reflecting what you're doing.
And it seems too like businesses should be maintaining those relative to changes in compliance if they're supposed to adhere to those things, right? Because, you know, back in the day, password policies and things like that were very different than what they are now. So if you're looking at, you know, the way that like HIPAA policy or HIPAA guidance or some of those other specific like policy and, you know, shit. Now I'm drawing a blank on that, but
I'll help you out.
compliance. That's the other word. So on the compliance side, you have changes that evolve over time. So when those things happen, that's a good reason, or like a good trigger to go back and review some of those other things that you've created to make sure that A, you're adhering to those properly relative to those changes. And B, if not, you can now make those necessary updates to those files in order to show that you're following those rules.
Yeah, passwords is actually extremely complicated at the policy level. If you take some regulations, technically PCI isn't a regulation, it's a contract, whatever. If you go to the 1X versions of them, they very specifically state what the password policy has to be, that it has to be at least 8 characters, has to be complex, has to be changed every 90 days and that sort of thing. However, if you go to NIST's current guidelines, you look at Microsoft's current guidelines, they throw that out the window and they say, no, that's phooey. It should be 12 characters or more. Done. That's it. So, okay. So we want to write our policy. If we're PCI, we can't do that because we're stuck over there. And then you also say, all right, we want to do 12 or more. You know, we're going to say, all right, 12 or more characters. And then you go over to, you know, your legacy, whatever, and it doesn't do more than 7.
Mm.
Crap. Now we're not in compliance with our policy. So now you got to like carve that out to say, you know, all right, this is what we're going to set. If there's an exception, we're going to, you know, do some kind of process to review that, bring it up to the best that we can, or maybe even look at alternatives. Maybe we need to upgrade that system.
Mm. Interesting. And there's a couple other things you mentioned in those things. So we're talking about the information security policy.
Yep.
We also mentioned a risk assessment,
yep,
which is not the same as a penetration test. It's not the same as like a security audit or anything, or like a red team or anything like that. Let's dive into the risk assessment side a little bit.
Yeah. So far what we've been talking about are more administrative type controls. If we're talking about, you know, administrative, technical, physical type controls, these are mostly administrative. So what we do in a risk assessment is we look around at the business and we say, all right, what kind of risks do we have? And ideally, you want these risks to be unique to you. So you might have 2 banks, right? They community banks, they do pretty much the same thing. You know, I mean, they've got lending and they've got, you know, all the things that go with a bank. However, if you do a risk assessment, even if you ask the same questions, the answers are going to come out different. So, and that's also different than like a compliance review. So we can look at the regulations, you know, we've got like FDIC and, you know, for that bank, they're going to say all the things you have to do. And when we do the controls assessment, we might say yes, 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 yes. So both banks come out yes for everything. However, there's still risk
mm-hmm.
for everything, and it's unique. So that risk assessment process is going through looking at those administrative, technical, and physical controls to say, where are our risks? That part of that is the penetration test.
I gotcha.
Part of that is the vulnerability assessments.
Mm-hmm.
We use those as inputs into the risk assessment. We use the policy. We use, you know, your training reports. We look at, you know, the qualifications of the IT team, or, you know, the relationships you have with your major critical third party vendors. And with that, we can say, all right, here's the big picture that we need to look at across the organization. Larger organizations, more complex, more highly compliant, that's probably something that you're going to want to hire out.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller businesses, HIPAA ones, for example, Health and Human Services puts out like a free kind of risk assessment questionnaire. It's something.
Yep.
You're required to have it by law. So, okay, well, it's something. It's going to find things. But the idea with that is we've got our risks. We can prioritize them. We can track them. And we can, you know, respond to them in some way.
Got it. Because some of the risks that you're going to identify are potential things that could happen, but completely unlikely. So, I mean, and that could take into account like weather related things or something like that, right? It's just like literally any sort of risk that could potentially impact your business. You want to document, see what, if you've addressed it, or if you have something in place to handle that. And if not, how much priority to assign to a specific risk in order to tackle it and put something into place, put a control in place. Like what's the goal outside of that risk assessment? Is just to identify things that you're to do next?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's make up a semi-realistic example. If you look at here in Syracuse, Syracuse University, they sit up on top of a hill. So their risk of flooding, which is a risk we'd certainly want to consider, is probably pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
They're at the top of the hill. However, if we looked at, you know, someone sitting next to a river that's known to flood, flood risk is very real.
Mm-hmm.
So the impacts and likelihoods, you know, change to adjust the priority of that. And so that would be considered differently, mm-hmm. obviously, between, you know, someone on the top of a hill looking at a flood risk versus here. Same, we could even say same here, risk of earthquake. Not something we would probably consider here in, you know, the upstate New York, Northeast region. But if you're over in California, that's probably a risk that a bank might consider over there.
Mm. Interesting. So it just seems like it just spans basically anything you can think of that could affect your business is something you could ask in that risk assessment side of things. And taking into account, like you said, other things like vulnerability management, penetration testing, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the other acronyms you threw out there, GRC. So I want to break that down just a little bit because I hear it a lot and I'm familiar enough with it, but other business owners may not completely understand what's involved with that. So the first part, governance, that's always an interesting topic to me to dive into a little bit, especially with a couple of things I want to get into here, but let's talk about governance a little bit and how you guys help out with that.
Yeah, so governance is actually one of the things that we focus on more and more because we see it as being more and more important. And we also see it as the one that's most often not considered. I mean, so far, even today, just in our talk, we've talked a lot about risk, which is that R in GRC. We talked about compliance, you know, HIPAA and, you know, FDIC and that sort of thing. So I think compliance is one that's easy to understand. You know, you have to be compliant with the laws or third-party service agreements. You got to be compliant with that kind of stuff. Risk, I mean, information security, when we get down to it, that's all we're doing is we're managing risk.
Mm-hmm.
But that governance piece, that's at an organizational level.
Now, let's start off with that definition. So how would you define the governance for a business?
Yeah, so let's take that small business that's let's take the bank. Well, let's stick with the bank example, because they're highly regulated and that sort of thing. And they're going to have governance, risk, and compliance within that. So at that governance side, you may have an IT team who's kind of focused on security. You may have, some kind of like IT director or, maybe an IT security analyst that are really looking and watching and keep an eye on that security. However, the leadership of the organization, the board of directors, maybe just a touch point. Mm-hmm. So take that board of directors example. They may be getting an annual update once a year to say, oh, by the way, we did a risk assessment, we did our pen testing, everything's good. Thank you very much. But the board of directors is really not providing any governance. They're not helping shape the organization. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the president. We want the president to, we don't want to tell them that, we failed our pen test because, we had some cross-site scripting and, some access control issues on our website and, clickjacking. We're not really worried about that. They don't know what that means.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of tech.
Yeah. A lot of tech. Yep, so what we need is to be able to translate that into risk to say, what's the business impact? So the president understands, look, if this happens, we've got these high risks. We've identified that on the physical side, if someone takes a manila folder and sticks it over the top of the door, it'll trigger the automatic sensor and they can get in. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to understand that the risk of that is that someone could get in unauthorized and that they could, do whatever bad things. So it kind of encompasses the entire organization. It also encompasses the employees. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have some kind of incident, who are they going to report it to? I think Paul, when you had him in, I think he mentioned that specifically.
Yeah.
Who's going to report it? That's governance. It's, getting the whole organization involved.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a little bit of like the oversight and understanding and how to tie all those different pieces together in a way that just helps an organization just encompass all of that security policy and procedure into one space.
Yeah.
So you mentioned like talking to those board members and those presidents and those folks that are not technical.
Yep.
And for the folks out here that are listening that aren't in those positions, like, how do you effectively communicate those findings, those types of things, in a way that the non-technical folks can understand it and take action against it, or understand, the things that the employees are shouting, hey, we need to invest in this. We need to change this.
Yep.
And they say, well, we don't have the budget, so sorry, can't do it. But there's clearly risk there. There's clearly a reason behind it. So how do those folks like convey those risks? How do they talk to those non-technical folks in order for them to understand it? And how do you do that, I guess, when you're working on behalf of a company?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most difficult skills to have, not just in cybersecurity, information security, but in IT as a whole, is being able to take a technical problem and being able to translate it into business terms so that the people that write the checks can understand what they're buying, why they're buying, and why it's so expensive, Sure. And like, what am I going to get out of that? We can't just say, hey, I really want to get this new, smoking hot Palo Alto firewall, because it's going to keep the bad guys out. And you're like, the business person might say, well, why can't we go with this other brand? Mm-hmm. Like, aren't they going to do kind of the same thing? Like, how do we know that this is going to keep the bad guys out? So what you end up doing is you need to be able to explain that, we need to upgrade because the systems are getting old and this, technology has changed. And we see that the feature set of, the Palo Alto, just again, to pick on Palo Alto or give them a free dig here, is going to be able to capture more of the bad threats coming in. It's going to keep people from clicking on bad emails. Mm-hmm. We know that clicking phishing emails, or after they're clicking, ending up at these watering holes, are going to be, one of the biggest risks to the organization. And the cost of that risk is that, you know, the most likely impact is going to be some kind of like business email compromise or worst case scenario, ransomware. And so the cost of our Palo Alto firewall is going to be significantly cheaper in the long run than the almost guaranteed business email compromise or potentially ransomware.
Got it. So one technique is, hey, here's say a report on our phishing assessment that we've done. It looks like everybody's going to click, or lots of people are going to click, and we're not going to be able to fully mitigate that. And the cost of them clicking could potentially be this type of dollar figure, right? Whether it's because we're dealing with interruptions to being able to function, maybe just all the time and effort to restore things. If we want to do that, paying them off, I guess, is one option. Or you can spend this lesser amount to upgrade our stuff and get us in a better place to do that. So talking to the C-levels and those upper folks, dollars seems to be one technique for doing that, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to explaining what they're getting out of it.
Mm.
And it doesn't necessarily have to tie specifically back to dollar value. It can be, you know, in terms of outcomes, you know, we can kind of dovetail off the business email compromise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that some of our customers send healthcare data via email or send their credit card payments via email. As a policy, our company says, no, you can't do that. But, you know, right now we can't stop them from doing it.
Sure.
So we would like to implement additional controls to do that. It may not have to be something that costs anything.
Mm.
You know, maybe you just tweak some of your rules to say, you know, look, we'd really like to do this, but the impact is going to be on the company that, you know, some of these emails are going to bounce back to the customer. You know, it might slow them down or might increase the number of phone calls or, you know, inconvenience them. You can take the classic, you know, CEO example that, you know, everybody except for me.
Sure.
But then they always end up being the one that are most valuable and most likely to actually be compromised. And everyone knows who the CEO of the company is anyway.
Sure. So, high value target. Of course.
Exactly. So, you know, everyone else has 12 character password and their password summer 2025.
Yeah. I remember back in the day working in like help desk tech support, there was always those carve outs, right? It's like, hey, here's the things that we're doing for everybody. By the way, the president of the company, they don't have to abide by that because it's too inconvenient for them or their assistant or something like that. And it's always rubbed me the wrong way, but it's, you know, it's coming from those folks that have the authority to make those decisions. So, now when I go back to it, I use examples like that, showing that like, hey, when you have those carve out examples, it's usually for people that are much more valuable from an attacker's perspective to target. So they should even be like, more require, like, you know, there should be more accountability and more focus on them, because, you know, compromising, you know, just like a, I don't know, just some random employee in the company may get you somewhere, but compromising the CEO of the company, I mean, you're going to get a lot more out of that sort of attack than you would from another one.
Oh yeah. And sometimes you can spread that to entire groups of people. I mean, I don't mean to, pick on healthcare systems or, you know, attorney practices, but we see a lot of like physicians, you know, medical providers, they'll say, no, I that's too inconvenient for me to have to do the multi-factor to get in. You know, I'm in the emergency room or in the operating room and I need to get in or that sort of thing. But they end up being the ones that get attacked. Same thing with like an attorney, you know, you end up with compromises of their email that includes their entire, you know, book and all the privileged information. And if they're in, you know, doing work for a compliant area, now we've got a compliance problem too. So, you know, it really needs to be consistent. And maybe that's one of those governance things that we talk about, to say, hey, we're having this problem. We need to overcome it. And we, as IT security people, as the IT department, the IT director, we don't have the authority to be able to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
So we need your help to implement that change.
Nice. I like that. Speaking on the governance side, I mentioned before that there's something I wanted to dive into a little bit. How are you handling the approach to the use of AI in businesses from like a security and governance standpoint, because I've been talking to businesses that, of course, their employees are going to be using it, right? They're going to find ways to make their jobs easier and more efficient, which is always a positive.
Absolutely.
But they're not taking into account, say, if they're working in healthcare or they're working in something with privileged information, controlling the where that data is going. Like, hey, yeah, I'm just going to have this thing create a spreadsheet out of all these emails or something like that for me, but now it contains patient information or some things like that. And they don't understand the process of, hey, that's all going externally to somebody else. And then it's coming back into a spreadsheet. Great. But now we don't have control of that data that went away. So how are you helping organizations in that regard?
Yeah, especially if you're using some kind of free application that's now going to feed that information into its, learning. So we can look at it from the administrative perspective. We can write ourselves a pretty policy that says, hey, you're not allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, you will be held accountable. That's only going to take you so far.
Sure.
And that also puts you in the big problem that, when the president does it, who's going to hold the president accountable for, not following that policy? You can do training around it to make sure people understand. We can try the technical approach of trying to block every single AI app and website that's out there. However, we know that it probably changes 100 times a day.
Sure. People get really creative too.
Yeah. On how to get around that kind of thing. The thing that I'm seeing from small businesses that seems to be most successful is to just embrace it by finding, and this is just around like your large language model kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Finding a solution that you're comfortable with and purchasing it for everybody, training everybody on the use of that, training them on, we're not going to put private data in there and that sort of thing. That seems to be fairly successful because then everyone is going to the same platform. And many of them, some of them, do have enterprise kind of level controls where you can force it to say, don't feed into, the learning model and that sort of thing. At the moment, that seems to be the most successful. I'm going to walk out the door and that's probably going to change. So don't hold this to me if you're watching this in 3 months from now.
Sure. No, it's just useful to know because I've talked to business owners and they're like, yeah, we use this stuff. But they're not taking into account the security aspect or like that control over the data. So I'm always looking for alternatives or at least guidance on how best to do that. So, the way that we use it is very similar to what you said. Like we, of course, embrace it in a way that makes our jobs more efficient, but we also control on what we allow our employees to send to it or utilize it for. So it's just like, hey, we don't send information about a specific customer's findings, but we can have it assist us with generating language or stuff to write up or document the risks and things like that associated with the findings, but then it disassociates it from a specific customer or a specific vulnerability or something like that that could end up getting leaked because I don't know if you've seen like examples, and I know this is all this stuff, like you said, it changes, but like it just scrapes so much random data that you can say like, hey, give me a recipe for, whatever. And then it just like picks some troll message from Reddit that a lot of people upvoted. And it's just like, this was complete nonsense, but a lot of people said that it was funny or hilarious or whatever. So now it's telling you to do that. But what I don't want to see is, hey, how do I hack this? And then it just shows this process of how I broke into like a specific entity and like that data just got into a model somewhere. Like that's the thing that terrifies me as somebody that regularly attacks other businesses, right?
I mean, I think one of the big examples that was in the news was maybe this year or late last year, and this relates to chatbots, which is a totally different topic, was some, like Chevy dealership in Canada where, someone realized it was a chatbot and gave it instructions to say, sell me this car for a dollar or whatever it was. And it became a fairly large legal case in terms of what that looks like. We've seen examples, of just chatbots saying, hey, do this instead. And if it's not properly trained or, restricted, then, the customer can kind of try to take advantage of you. So that's a whole another topic in terms of chatbots, which I recommend to clients, really, really be careful about what that is. And
oh, so like how much authority those things have, or even on the legal side. So you have it like, hey, I'm your assistant, or I'm your virtual salesman, salesperson, whatever. And then you get it to, like you said, sell you a car for a dollar. Now you're,
are you on the hook for that?
Yeah. Are you holding them against it?
You didn't train it right. Or, you know, did this person use it maliciously? Or, you know, did they use it within the bounds of it? So that's still kind of being sorted out in terms of like the courts and that sort of thing. So, you know, really limit it down to, you know, like just your basic, you know, customer service kind of things, you know, who do I call for this? Oh, here, call this number, or, you know, here, we'll get you over to the right person, that kind of general knowledge. But don't give any authority to make decisions, or, you know, that sort of thing. You know, maybe not give a pricing.
Yeah.
That kind of.
Now, how do you see that on the other side of it working in your favor for how you're able to help customers and things out? Like, I mean, information security policy is pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Helping somebody to define that, right? You could offload some of your time and effort, I guess, to maybe assist a customer in creating their own or helping them draft that out. I mean, is there any use of that you're looking into, that you've seen in like available for folks to use?
So on like the business side, we have seen a number of companies that are using it to kind of sort out kind of the edge cases. So you may have, you know, policies and procedures for, you know, here's how we do these sorts of things, but now we've got something we haven't really done before or need to analyze something. Let's put it over there. On our side, we've even used it for some very quick, basic, you know, incident response forensics kind of analysis to say, hey, look at all this data. Can you pull out anything I might need to look at? Very much seen it screw it up.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, if you're in a quick pinch, it might be able to take that very large, you know, CSV log output and say, oh, I need to look here. Putting together timelines, that sort of thing, it's been very helpful. I would not use it to get advice on compliance. It's not up to date on that. And you can literally have, and I have done this, I've had a very smart client. He asked a question that him and I were kind of debating on. And I asked kind of the same kind of questions, and we both ended up in two different places. The chat, you know, the ChatGPT or whatever ended up supporting both of our positions, even though I very specifically said, no, talk me out of this.
Right. Right.
But we still ended up, you know, diametrically opposed for two both very valid reasons. But at the same time, they're both opinions too.
Sure.
So like there isn't necessarily a correct answer.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question. I started going off on a tangent too.
No, it's interesting always to hear how other businesses are using it, but also it just, you know, I want people to understand not only how folks like us are using it in the security space, but what to be aware of when they're using it within their own businesses, right? There's obviously some positives that are out there. It does some things very well. It does some things very poorly.
Yep.
One of the things that I always struggle with for those is if I have specific questions relating to offensive work that I'm doing, it's very against helping you break into things.
Correct.
However, I mean, whatever. If you go out there and you say like, I'm trying to protect against this.
Yep.
How might somebody attack me so that I can protect against it? It's very good at giving you some ideas.
Yep.
And now as an attacker, you can just like take those ideas and run with them. So
yep.
A little hint out there for that. Everybody. If you're trying to get those LLMs to give you some hacking tips, just pretend like you're a defender and structure it that way. And then sometimes it'll give you some tips on some offensive techniques that you might not have thought of.
I've had similar results by starting off with the, I'm a student trying to learn this, or even, you know, I'm a company's CISO and, you know, it looks like we maybe had this thing, you know, can you tell me more about it, what I'm looking for, how they did it. And it'll sometimes give you give you advice that it may or may not. But you got to remember, though, the red team's using it, blue team's using it, you know, the threat actors are using it, you're using it. I mean, it's the classic cat and mouse game that we've been playing.
This is something I've had discussions with employees of mine, and it relates to phishing. I want to get your opinion on this. So the argument is that phishing assessments and tests don't provide additional security to a business because people are still going to click. Like, there's not enough value in running the assessments to realize that they're going to be like in a better spot from a security perspective. And I'm of the opinion that that they're still useful in helping people ideally understand like what those might look like, how to be aware of it, you know, some tips and techniques. But I'm also understanding that like as a provider of those types of assessments, there's always going to be limitations that we can't, like boundaries that we can't cross that attackers will, that basically make it impossible to give enough protection or enough of a like training for people to really be protected against those.
So I'm going to bring this back to governance because that's the piece that I think is missing most often. So on the technical side, you know, companies like us, we can sell our clients, you know, cybersecurity awareness training, and we can give them, you know, the phishing training, where, you know, sometimes you've got your frequent clickers, you know, that sort of thing. The thing that ends up being most successful is when you've got that governance, when you've got that culture to actually address it, to say, oh, look, Sue clicked twice mm-hmm. in the last 6 weeks. And not just on the IT side, you know, whoever's reading the report going, crap, Sue clicked twice. She's probably the one that's going to click.
Mm-hmm.
No, you take that, you know, kind of out onto the business side. It now becomes a business problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another one of those disconnects that we have in a lot of organizations is trying to throw an IT problem or IT solution at a business problem. So on the business side, you know, we need to sit down and say, hey, look, this is what could really happen. This could be a problem. Even on the technical solution side, some companies will say, all right, well, let's put her in remedial training, you know, make her watch another hour of videos or whatever, right. And hopefully that'll teach her. It doesn't, you know, so you really need to have that manager sitting down or someone within IT that's, you know, empowered to be able to kind of coach on that and ideally have consequences up to and including termination. That's the hard one. And I think that's the biggest gap there is not filling in that part other than to just say, crap, 2% of the company's clicking.
Right.
Well, that means you need to talk to 2% of your company. Governance gets down to a lot of those kind of like repeat problems. If you've got a problem that keeps repeating, if you look at the source, it's probably governance. You probably don't have a process to deal with it.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense that, you know, in a vacuum, part of that argument makes sense. But like in the larger viewpoint of a business, including like the risk side, the governance side, the compliance side, I think you make a good point there. So it's going to give me some stuff to think about because I've always taken it that when I'm running an assessment, like a phishing assessment or security awareness, I don't attribute it to specific people. I attribute it to statistical, like,
yep,
this is the breakdown either by department or whatever, but not to like a specific person is more likely to do that so that they need to be either more, like you said, exposed to training or consequences or those types of things. To me, it indicates and what I try to do for the company is this is the likelihood that somebody is going to click. So let's then take the next step at understanding what might happen. So like that assumed breach sort of a scenario, and then putting in and identifying the protections to allow people to make mistakes and that you have safeguards that it's not just, hey, it's Sue or it's, you know, whoever. Just being able or just being like terrified to lose their job because of every email that comes in. It's just like, okay,
yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah. You certainly don't want that, but you want to have like, okay, I wanted to take take a look at things and have security mindset, but I also want to have safeguards in place so that they're not worried about it. Like I want to celebrate people that are doing the right thing, that are reporting these things or, you know, just ignoring them or whatever the case may be. I want to celebrate that to you. I guess make that positive feedback loop versus a negative where it's just like, oh shit, I clicked again.
Yeah.
Like I don't want anybody to know that I clicked, so I'm not going to say anything. You know what I mean? I want to be like, oh, I clicked. It doesn't look like it was a training thing. So let's make sure that something malicious didn't happen because otherwise shit, I don't want to lose my job, so I'm not going to say anything.
Right.
You know, and it's like that.
And that should be part of, that should be part of that whole thing too, to say, I clicked, you know, is, you know, this is what I clicked on. You know, we need to, you know, is this something you need to look at and not hide? Because I'll give you an example. I've worked at a number of hospitals, so this is not any of the, any of my employers. This was a client. They had a ransomware event and the IT team was trying to identify where the ransomware was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the IT side, they're looking at logs, trying to figure it out. Okay, we got an IP address. Okay, that narrows it down to a network closet. Okay, now we got to, you know, like literally trying to trace it back, you know, going behind down the OSI stack to get to that physical layer. We've got people, you know, at that point we're on site, we got people walking around. We're like, okay, it seems to be on this floor. And we find out that it's a computer over in the corner. We're like, hey, what's going on with this computer? And the nurses and techs and whatever are like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's been kind of acting funny for the last couple hours. And, you know, we just don't have time to deal with it. We don't know what's going on. So meanwhile, I've been sitting there for 8-10 hours across two different shifts, you know, just doing its ransomware, plugging away at all the servers and stuff like that. All it would have taken was someone to call, but there was no like urgency or empowerment or, you know, anything to say, I should probably report this.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to have a big impact, but I also can report it knowing that, you know, I'm not going to be kicked out.
Sure.
And what it ended up being was someone was like looking at a dentist office to try to get their son a dentist appointment, you know, which, okay, maybe your acceptable use says not to do that. But most companies are going to be like, that's a reasonable use of the computer. So, you know, sure, no one did anything wrong, but you know, you've got IT in a panic running around looking at something and you got 15 people like, oh, it's over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of that too, like the clicking on the email and doing that thing. I remember my first ever exposure to penetration testing was in a job that I did. Oh gosh, it was probably 20 years ago now. It was an unannounced, I worked in IT. It was an unannounced pen test and I was on help desk and I was the type of person that's always there to get shit figured out for somebody, right? I'm there, friendly, helpful, yep, doing it. Somebody called me up. They're like, hey, I got this email and I don't know, just it didn't open when I tried clicking. I was like, okay, whatever. It's just, that happens.
Yeah.
And so that was my first time. And I remote into the system and I was like, okay, show me what you're trying to do. And they're like, oh, here's this email. I'm clicking on it. I was like, oh yeah, that's really strange. And ended up being that was a phishing email with a malicious attachment. And then me logging in gave them, you know, cash credentials on the system, yeah, because I'm an administrator on the network.
You're probably a local administrator.
And then, so like, I was part of the whole compromise chain. And after the fact, I was like, ah, oh, damn it. Like, there's nothing I could do there. Like, I'm just being helpful trying to log in and do that. But that's all that it took for them is just like one person calling up just with like a random question. And I'm just trying to be helpful and, you know, basically allowed the entire network to get taken over. And I never forgot that. That was the first exposure that I had. And yeah, it's still like the same valid path today. That's what's funny is like 20 years later, you go down that same route and you're still going to have some success there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have any other interesting stories from your, I mean, you don't do as much pen testing now, but you did a lot of, pen testing a little bit before, right? So, any interesting stories from something there that was unique or, I don't know, just blew your mind a little bit?
I think the one that blew my mind the most was doing a, external pen test, for a company. It was the second year. They had failed miserably the year before for us. And so this was a repeat for us. And all we did was harvest whatever email addresses we could find, went on LinkedIn, and we just went through. And the only passwords we tried were the four seasons and the year of the pen test. And of the 3,000 users, we got like 30, 40 emails. From there, the first email address we logged into, the gentleman who was using that was using his work email to correspond with his mistress. full X-rated photos. That was a big surprise because when we got in, we're like, hey, let's start looking for attachments.
Right. That's what you do, right?
Yeah, you look for attachments. You're like, what kind of data are they? You know, because I mean, the email may not have it, but the data, you know, if you can find attachments, you know, some Excel sheet, you know, may have hundreds.
So now you're getting into spicy pictures.
And I'm like, oh my God, am I reporting this? Am I not reporting this? So we got into that ethical dilemma. But from there, you know, we were able to log into Citrix, got ourselves a workstation, you know, so we already got the 30 users, start doing just a password splash, you know, using it. PowerShell, we ended up with 500 more users, including a domain administrator that was a third-party service provider that hadn't logged in 3 years.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Pulled the SAM file. We said, hey, let's see what we can... The SAM file is the Active Directory password list.
Yeah.
That's got everyone's password in there. And a super not secure format. We did some offline attacking on that. And of the 3,000 users, we were able to get, I think, like 2,100 of the users. We were able to recover the passwords. And it was like 20% of users were using the same password as someone else in the company.
Mm.
That one was kind of the... I mean,
that's crazy to me.
You hear all those password statistics and that sort of thing, but to actually see it was like a, you know, sit back in your chair and go, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if we run through that attack chain,
yep.
Common password,
yep.
Going after their external email provider, whatever yep. that was, you got into 30 or so accounts, but one had some interesting findings.
Yep.
And then credentials into Citrix.
Yep.
And then from Citrix, you're able to move laterally.
Yep.
Get a list of all the internal users, basically yep. through.
That was through an SNMP that was set up on a Windows server.
Okay.
I don't know what that was for, but it pulled down all the domain users for us.
And then there was they had an external service provider that was a domain admin that hadn't logged in. They just never deactivated the account, didn't go stale, anything like that.
Yep.
So I gave you domain admin, which is always like now once you're domain admin, you don't have anything.
But I mean, you're going to keep going if you got more time, obviously.
Yeah, and then getting the SAM file, which that's always a common technique, right? Because they have all the passwords for every user secured, obviously hashed.
Yep.
So they're not just like readable, but then you take them down and you go ahead and try and crack those to see what you can get. Yeah, I've never seen anybody that's had. Unless they have like a common password policy, like that was the thing that I always love is, and this is, I'm like just tangent and like, but there'll be a company and they'll have this procedure where it's like, oh, when you need a password reset, we're always going to reset it to this for you. And yep. then often sometimes those will get reset and those accounts just never get deactivated or whatever. And once you get that, you spray that everywhere. And it's just like, oh, this is your password that you start for everything. It's not just like a unique password each time. It's just yep. that, oh.
Or there's just something, yeah, something common.
Like welcome one or welcome 123 or something like that. I remember that we did that, you know, back in the day. That was just the thing. It's like, okay, we reset it. It's welcome 123. I didn't think about the fact that, well, maybe they didn't change it after that. Now all of a sudden there's a compromise, you know, potential compromise or multiple people that are using that same password.
That wasn't even the case though, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, there was some of that. Yeah. But within that 20-30% those common passwords, they were not help desk issued password. Cause like when we did the, you know, after action report, you know, review of the report, the IT team's like, no, that's not what we give as the password. We do the welcome 123.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, yeah. Okay. We found a bunch of that.
But yeah.
No, there was a ton of it like that. Part of that too, it was a healthcare provider. We had enough to also get into their main, EMR application. So, not only did we have the whole domain, but we also had every single one of their medical records. And then, of course, going through those email addresses, we found a lot of stuff there. And we found a whole bunch of other findings, but
sure.
those were kind of... But I mean, if you think about that in context, though, too, this started as an external black box penetration test. And, you know, within 20 hours of effort, to which I would say that's not a really high level of skill. I mean, that's almost script kiddie level stuff there that we were able to, you know, own the whole place.
Yeah.
And that was after they had somewhat similar problems the year before too. let's get us back to governance. Governance would have fixed that. It would have said that this is a priority. It would have been beyond, you know, someone in IT saying, oh man, you know, we really messed up on this thing. Let's, you know, let's get the organization around this.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Then there's something I wanted to dive into a little bit as we're getting close to wrapping up here. But one of the things that is always very interesting from a pen testing perspective is that post-compromise set of activities, because as an adversary, an emulated adversary, I'm going to dig into whatever I have access to see if it gets me to that next step.
Yep.
And in that case, if it's email, I'm going to be digging through emails, right? And just seeing if there's anything sensitive that I can pull, like you said, credentials. And sometimes it comes into other things that you don't expect.
Yep.
And there's always a lot of, like, it's a really imperative thing when I'm training somebody to understand the proper way to go through that process of things, yes, because you don't want to be, first of all, just, you know, going after it, like just not having any boundaries, any guardrails or anything. Right. So you're always trying to take like a responsible route, but you're also trying to find the best path forward to demonstrate how this can impact the organization. And we were doing an assessment one time for a county government, and we had accessed several different sectors of the government, and one of which was the law enforcement, right? And then there's inside law enforcement was things like evidence and stuff like that. And I was like, listen,
you got chain of custody problems.
We're not even going to try digging anything out of that because that can screw up on the legal side some very significant things. So, you know, there are limitations where, again, a true adversary might just go and dig into all that stuff, like you said, compromise chain of evidence or chain of custody or any of those types of things. So there's always like, I don't know, it's just some thought and some app, you know, some let's take a step back and look at some of this stuff. But more often than not, we're seeing interesting things like that. You know, we're seeing personal account information, personal passwords, those types of things. Which is always, it's always just like a very uncomfortable position to be in when you're like, you're not going in there looking for somebody's, you know, personal pictures and those types of things in their email. Just like, absolutely, hey, that happens. And now it puts you in a new position. Like, what do we do with that? So, that's one of the things that I want to just put out there is like anybody that's doing this is like to always just, you know, keep your mind focused on the tasks at hand and like, I don't know. It's like you have that power, right? So just use it responsibly in those engagements and not just because it's piquing your curiosity. Like, oh, maybe I can, you know, maybe they have whatever.
Yep.
Like that's just not the way to go. First of all, it'll burn you with the customer.
Yep.
And secondly, it's not going to be useful in what they're paying you to do regardless. So it doesn't benefit you there.
So maybe it's helpful to kind of talk through how we handle that sort of situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I am curious about that.
So for us, you know, we have the contract to do the penetration test. We also go through the rules of engagement as a separate document in which we kind of talk about, you know, what kind of are the limits? If you have like a healthcare organization, if you have a healthcare organization, we're going to put in place a business associate agreement that gives us the legal ability to view in an authorized manner healthcare information that we may come across.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to say things like, well, what happens if we do get in? So, okay, we're on that Citrix server, you know, we're on a workstation, you know, or whatever. What do? Do we notify you and stop? Do we go past that?
Yep.
That sort of thing. How far do we take it? Say, okay, well, now we've got this Citrix machine. Are we okay with using this? Can we pivot to other servers, whatever, what or not? And you may not get into that level of detail, but we kind of set up milestones. So when we get to it, we call them up, our lead on this, and we say, this is where we're at. You've pretty much failed, you know, or sure, we've got some pretty high significant. Do you want us to keep going? And then we're like, okay, I've got the SAM file. Do you want me to download it? Do you want to do some password analysis, you know, sure, while we're at it? You know, I'm not going to give you, you know, here's the CEO's password, but I mean, we can give you some statistics. And so we did, we broke down the statistics and that sort of thing. When it came to that user's email address that we got into with the personal information, I asked them somewhat vague questions to try to figure out what their policy is. Because I didn't want to give them information if they didn't have, for example, policies and procedures in terms of monitoring employee data, because that could be considered monitoring.
Sure.
You know, and well, what's your policy on personal use? I mean, it was, you know, it was consensual from, I mean, I didn't get into the details, but you know, of whether where we're at on this, but you know, and it ended up, I ended up generically saying, well, one of these employees seems to be using it for personal, you know, as that, what information are we doing this? And they, you know, all right, let us get with HR or whatever. And they said, sure. All right, thanks for telling us. We're just going to have to educate.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you could at least tell us the department.
No, it's always an interesting situation when you come across those completely unexpected to or unrelated to what you're actually there to do. And then you have to decide how do we approach something like
that? Yeah, how do you plan for that?
Yeah, because you're not ready for any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Brent, I appreciate you coming on. It's been a while since I've wanted to do this. Where can people find you? Where can people reach you?
Yeah, we're at ryan-secure.com. Find me on LinkedIn as well. Happy to talk, whether it's even just, you know, kind of a giving you some advice on how and what to do that you might be able to do on your own, or see if we can come in and help.
See, I love that. I love when people are willing to just provide that educational side of it. And then if it's too much, then hey, we're happy to help you. But otherwise, here's enough to do it on your own if you want to do so.
More than happy to point you to the free resources. And if you get stuck, give us a call.
Awesome. Appreciate that. That's it for us here. I want to thank everybody at the studio, Danny and Mike behind the scenes, helping us get all this stuff processed and all the recordings done. So thanks to Growth Mode Media for that. And until next time, this has been Hack Dissection.